And Estelle and I went in March on my study break in our camper down to Arbuckle Lake, and for 4 days I did nothing but read and study commentaries on Habakkuk. I came back with about 48 messages in Habakkuk. Now, that seems a little extreme since there's only three chapters in Habakkuk. It's not very long. And I reduced that down considerably to our outline that we're on right now. As I continue in preparation and in preaching, I wished I would have stuck with the 48 messages and went ahead and carried it out in a lot of ways, because there's so much to be covered. And I am choosing particularly topics. I'm choosing the one or two things out of each section of Habakkuk that I think is pertinent not only to myself, where I live, what God's speaking to me, but where I believe you live and what he's speaking to you, and where we as a church live and what he's speaking to us. And as we continue looking in Habakkuk chapter 2, as we continue, verses 2 and following are the prophecy that God gave Habakkuk. It's the words that God gave Habakkuk and told him to write down, to pen these down, to put them down on the tablet, on the paper. He didn't want anybody to misunderstand them. He didn't want anybody to forget what they were. He wanted them retained. He didn't want to leave it to Habakkuk's memory. He didn't want to leave it to an oral tradition to be able to be passed down from generation to generation by storyline, although that did take place. He said, I want you to pen it. I want you to write it down. I want you to carve it in the stone. I want you to make it legible. I want you to make it readable. I want it to be made where everybody can have a clear understanding and know in detail what's going to happen, where we are. And he said, I want you to do this, and I want you to lay it out before people. And so this is what we're doing, is we're looking at what God gave Habakkuk. This is not something just Habakkuk thought up on his own as a good storyline. This is what God gave Habakkuk. It is the answer to Habakkuk's prayer, how long and why am I going to have to continue to see the violence? And it's the answer to Habakkuk's prayer when he goes back to God after God tells him, I'm raising up the Chaldeans to bring judgment on the house of Israel, half the house of Judah in Jerusalem. And he goes back to God and he says, that doesn't make sense. Can you explain why to me? And this is God's answer to Habakkuk. And we've been looking at this continuously. We looked last week at the first of five woes that God said. Now you write this down, Habakkuk. This is first number one woe, and you write it down, and here's woe number two, verses 9 through 11. And we're going to look at that woe, that God's pronouncement of judgment on the Chaldeans today, and we'll continue to look at the other woes in the future. Let's stand together, if you will, in honor of reading God's Word. If you don't have a Bible with you, that passage is on a bulletin, and I hope you picked one up when you came in the door out on the table. If you didn't pick one up beforehand, get one as you leave so that you'll have remembrance of everything that's going on throughout the week and upcoming time. God told Habakkuk to write this down, and it begins in verse 9. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to put his nest on high, to be delivered from the hand of calamity. You have devised a shameful thing for your house by cutting off many peoples, so you are sinning against yourself. Surely the stone will cry out from the wall, and the rafter will answer it from the framework. You may be seated. Now, you just read that in, you know, June of 2000 in Norman, Oklahoma, and you go, huh? That doesn't make any sense at all. What does that mean? Woe to one who evil gains for his house, and what does it mean about a nest on high, and you know, cutting off people and sinning against yourself, and stones crying out, and the rafters will answer? It doesn't make sense, because as God spoke to Habakkuk, he spoke in a Hebrew dialect, or gave him this understanding, and Habakkuk wrote it out in the Hebrew dialect, and he also wrote it out in the Hebrew culture. He wrote it out in an Eastern culture. He wrote it out in such a way, and God somehow told Habakkuk to write these things down, and it's out of poetry that they come, which is, you know, interesting because most of us who grew up in America as macho men like myself who grew up in America, you know, big boys don't cry and all this kind of stuff. You know, you didn't deal with poetry. That was kind of sissified, you know. But the God of God, the Lord of Lords, the King of Kings, the Creator of the heavens and the earth, he told them in poetry terms. He gave out some, through linguistics, he gave out literature that gives us a communication about what he's meaning, what he's saying. And God is pronouncing his judgment on the Chaldeans. And what he's telling Habakkuk is, don't worry about how the unrighteous is going to judge the righteous. Just understand that the unrighteous is going to be held accountable for their unrighteousness. And he told us that last week when we looked at verses 6 through 8. And we're looking now at verses 9 through 11. And we're going to look at, as we see this, the insight into the motives of Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, who led his dictatorship all over the known world at that time and overtook everywhere. Violence was everywhere. And God told Habakkuk, listen, I'm going to bring the Chaldeans in. You're not going to believe it. Man, their horses are so fast, and they have cruel, their army is so cruel. They care nothing about human rights. They care nothing about other people. They only care about themselves. They have a pride that is as big as Mount Everest. You're not going to believe the judgment that this unrighteous group of people are going to bring on the righteous house of Judah, because Judah has fallen from the obedience of God. You're not going to believe this judgment. And now he's given us a little bit of insight into the way Nebuchadnezzar is thinking. When he says to him, woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, the phrase for his house gives us a little bit of understanding about where Nebuchadnezzar is coming from. Because God knows all things. God knows our hearts. You know, we can try to fool everybody else around us, but God knows our heart. He knows what we're thinking. He knows our motives. We can put a smile on our face and make it seem like, oh, this is something we're doing and we're so spiritual, and everybody is supposed to look at us and say, boy, they really do that with a pure heart. But God knows the heart of people. God knows the heart of the wicked as well as the righteous. And so as he looked into the heart of Nebuchadnezzar, he's showing Habakkuk a little bit of why Nebuchadnezzar is doing what he's doing. He's doing it for his house. In fact, an inscription in the ancient city of Babylon says this, and archaeology has found this, that Nebuchadnezzar wrote, one of the chief purposes for strengthening the walls of Babylon, the city, was to make an everlasting name for his reign. Now, that was for him personally, but his reign and that understanding of Eastern culture was not just for him. It was for his posterity. It was for his family. It was for his children. He was trying, as he knew how, to build something for his house, for his people. He was trying to secure a life for his family. And so this is what we see when he says, woe to him who gets evil gain for his family. He was saying, he's getting it in an evil way. In fact, it's a covetous way. He's saying the Hebrew word doesn't only mean evil gain, it means coveting. He covets others. And so that's what it says. Nebuchadnezzar went after what everybody else had because he was not satisfied with what he had alone. And he wanted something more, not only for himself, but for his family. He wanted more and more and more for his family. He was trying to provide a legacy and a heritage for his kids and for his kids' kids, his grandkids. So he built a city and he built an empire that would try to withstand all of eternity, and so it would be everlasting, so he would stand and his name would stand, but it would be a provision for his whole family, his children, his wives, his brothers, his sisters, his people. The cruelty and the violence that he imparted on other people was simply so that he could provide a name for himself. The cruelty and the violence was so that he could give a heritage to his children, to his family. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar's palace in the city of Babylon, when the archaeologists have uncovered it, the outer wall of his palace was 136 feet thick. Now, you're talking about a huge wall. I mean, big wall. It was a huge wall. And on every brick, now I don't know how big the bricks are, but on every brick that was manufactured and laid in that wall, every brick had the name Nebuchadnezzar on it. He had every brick with his name on it because he was leaving a legacy, not only of himself, but he was leaving a legacy of his family. In fact, the terrace inside the palace is called the Hanging Garden. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world that he developed and built this garden inside his home, not only for himself, but for his family. It was a place where his family could enjoy themselves. And so he built there was the city of Babylon, and inside the city of Babylon was this huge palace. It was Nebuchadnezzar's palace. And it had a wall all the way around it to protect it. And inside this palace, not only did it have rooms and everything else, but it had a garden. It had a humongous hanging garden, an unbelievable structure. Even today, it would amaze us. And that was a place where his family could be protected and enjoy life without having to go out into the places of the people and without any threat, he thought, of anybody coming in. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar named his palace the Marvel of Mankind. Now, that's what he called it, the Marvel of Mankind. He built his palace off of the slavery of other people because they would go and take captive people, and then they would bring those people back to Babylon, and then they were slaves. He built it off of the spoils of other nations, because whenever he would go and he would conquer another nation, then he would steal whatever they had, bricks, rocks, trees. He would steal and scavenge everything over the landscape. He would take anything and everything he wanted, and he would take it back to Babylon, and he put it into his palace. In fact, one of the things that he took out of the Jerusalem, out of the temple, was all the artifacts of the temple worship, all the artifacts of Solomon's temple, all the gold, all the lampstand, everything he took. In fact, if you'll remember, in Daniel chapter 5, when Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar's son, was having his on top of the world party, it says that he sent his servants and said, go get the artifacts that my father took from the temple of Jerusalem, and we're going to drink out of those artifacts. We're going to make merry out of these things. And that was his way of saying, we trampled over the God of Israel, my father did, and I'm going to mock that God by taking these religious artifacts, and I'm going to make a party out of them, and we're going to mock God out of it. You see, he took everything, Nebuchadnezzar took everything back to his palace. He took people back. That's where Daniel went whenever he captured Jerusalem and he took Daniel captive. Daniel went back to the palace in Babylon. He went back to this humongous place, and through Daniel's leadership, part of that leadership, all these things were developed. All these bricks were laid through labor that was coerced on other people. Nebuchadnezzar fortified his house to protect his family and himself. But the way that he did it, God says, brought shame. You see, you can have pure motives, in a sense. You can do things for a right reason sometimes. But the way you do it can bring shamefulness to yourself and to your family. See, that's what God says. You have devised a shameful thing for your house. This thing that you tried to do for your house, this thing that you tried to do for your family, the way that you did it has brought shamefulness not only to you but to your family. And history records that. History records it very well, of this shamefulness that he has. And then he goes on and he says, the stones will cry out and the rafters will answer. And all that God is saying in his poetic way commissioned Habakkuk to write these down, is he was saying, the stones that you stole from other countries, the people that you used to build this building, the wood that you stripped the land of Israel and other lands from and brought back here and built this up, these very stones, these very rafters, they stand as a testimony of your evil, of your cruelty, of your violence, of the way that you went about trying to provide something for your family, the injustice that you used, the pride that built you up and that brought you down. Nebuchadnezzar's pursuit for security through power, through wealth, and through walls caused him to sin against himself. In fact, that's where God tells him, you did all of this, and it caused you to sin against yourself. And that's when God says to him, his nest was on high, cutting off many people. This was this protection. This was this wall. An eagle takes and places his nest up real high so that predators can't get to the family. And that's what he's picturing Nebuchadnezzar doing, taking his home and building it in such a secure way that the predators can't get in. But Nebuchadnezzar was sinning against himself, and we read that because in Daniel chapter 4, we read of Nebuchadnezzar walking around his city. Let me find out where I am here. Chapter 4, verse 28 following, Nebuchadnezzar's walking around his palace and walking around the city of Babylon, and it says 12 months later, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace in Babylon. The king reflected and said, Is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and the glory of my majesty? And while the words was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared, sovereignty has been removed from you, and you will be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place will be with the beast of the field. You will be given grass to eat like cattle, and 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on him, on whomever he wishes. Immediately, the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled, and he was driven away from mankind, began eating grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. What happened was Nebuchadnezzar lost his mind. He went nuts. He was thinking of himself on top of the world, walking around his palace and enjoying everything that he's built. And in his heart and in his mind and in his voice, he was saying, look at what I have done. And God said, your pride has caused you to fall. I will show you now who is king. I will show you who is sovereign. And the voice of heaven spoke and told Nebuchadnezzar, this is what's going to happen. And Nebuchadnezzar lost his mind. He went nuts. And history records that there was a time when Nebuchadnezzar became sick. The king of Babylon became sick, and he was insane. And he lost his mental capability, his reasoning capability. And he literally was eating grass, and his hair grew out in a strange way. His nails would grow because he would not take care of himself. He was an animal, living like an animal. He had lost everything. He committed spiritual suicide. He committed spiritual suicide when in pride he stood up and said, my security is in this power, is in this wealth, or in these walls. This is my security. This is where I am. We do know that Nebuchadnezzar did come out of that. The following few verses say, but at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason returned to me. Now notice that he raised his eyes toward heaven. There was finally a place whenever Nebuchadnezzar got to the place in his mind and in his heart when God sovereignly told him he would, he looked to heaven and he said, God, you're God, I'm not. And he says, my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what hast thou done? At that time my reason returned to me, and my majesty and splendor were restored to me for the glory of my kingdom, and my counselors and my nobles began seeking me out, so I was established in my sovereignty, and surpassing greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are true, and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. Nebuchadnezzar did what he did to try to provide for himself and his family. How he did it was wrong, and God's judgment fell on him. History's recorded it, and we can see that. He built a nest on high. He cut people off. He thought he was trying to protect himself and his family from calamity, from evil, from destruction. And in pride, he said to himself, I can do it on my own. I've done it all myself. I don't need any help. This is my power. This is my strength. This is my might. And God said, no, it's not. And God brought him down and humbled him. Now, what does this mean to us today? I mean, this is a history lesson. But how are some of the same ways today that you and I commit spiritual suicide? How are some of the same ways that you and I do nothing different than what Nebuchadnezzar did? Some of the ways that God looks into our heart, and I am thankful, at least up till this point, God has not commissioned anybody else to write what's in my heart. Aren't you? I mean, aren't you thankful? We know what was in Nebuchadnezzar's heart because God commissioned Habakkuk to write it. Aren't you kind of glad that God hasn't told anybody to write down what's in your heart? I'm glad God's not told anybody to write down what's in my heart because I know what's in my heart too many times. Too many times I do things and then I look in my heart and I say, oh boy, that motive wasn't really near as pure as what I thought it was. Well, the way I did that was just as dirty as it could be. I mean, I did it because I wanted to. Oh man, I'm guilty before you, God. But how are some of the ways that you and I commit spiritual suicide? Well, I believe there's three things I want us to look at that I believe that go along with the text. And that is, you and I commit spiritual suicide in our lives when we try to gain and try to hold on to security through power, through wealth, and through walls. The first way is through power. You and I try to gain security in our lives when we try to gain or hold on to power. Now, how do we do that as a religious person, as a Christian, as someone who is involved in church maybe? Well, one of the ways we do that is we assume responsibility or authority over something that's not ours. Now, at Grace Fellowship, we have a philosophy of ministry. And we've gone over that several times. We draw it in the form of a triangle. And we say on one side of the triangle is responsibility. On the other side of the triangle is authority. And on the bottom of that triangle is accountability. And that is that if you're given responsibility for something, then you're given authority for it. If you're not given a responsibility, then you don't have authority. Don't assume responsibility if you're not given a responsibility. Don't assume authority if you're not given authority. Everybody is accountable to somebody, to God, to one another. We're all accountable. This is our philosophy of ministry. So how is it that sometimes we can try to hold on to our security through power or through control in this way? Well, let me just say that I think sometimes in church life, one of the ways that we do that is we covet somebody else's ministry. We covet somebody else's ministry. Just like Nebuchadnezzar coveted what other people had. We covet somebody else's ministry. We desire, we see somebody else's ministry and we covet after it. We think, oh, God must be so much more pleased with them. Look at what they're doing. Look at what they're doing. They're either teaching or preaching or they're singing or they're doing something. God surely is more pleased with what they're doing than what I'm doing. We began to covet somebody else's ministry, and whenever we began to covet that ministry, just like Nebuchadnezzar, when he would covet something, and then he began to devise the plan to take over. Sometimes that's what happens in church life. We give somebody the responsibility of a ministry and we give them corresponding authority to it, and then somebody comes along and begins to covet that ministry, and so what do? Through evil means, they begin even deceiving themselves to try to take over the ministry that they covet. They began to pull the rug out from underneath the people that have responsibility and authority for that ministry. They began to, just slowly dropping a little hints here and there about how dissatisfied they are with the way that that person's doing ministry. If I were doing that ministry, it would be done a different way, a better way, a more effective way. You see, that's nothing less. That's absolutely nothing less than what Nebuchadnezzar was doing when he came into the places of Israel, when he came into the Medes and to the Persians, when he said, you can't run your country the way you're supposed to. I'm coming in. I'm taking over. We're dissolving everything, and we're starting the way I want it to be done. I covet it. If you've been in church life very long or if you've been involved in ministry, it's not hard to find somebody a lot of times who will covet the ministry that you have if you have a ministry. And they'll begin to tell you a little bit here and there, and you'll begin to get wind of things that come through other people. Oh, I think you could do that ministry a little bit different if you just did this. I think you could do that ministry a little bit better if you did this. Oh, don't you think that Brother Chuck could do a better job if he did this? Let me tell you, coveting somebody else's ministry is trying to build your own house through evil games. Build your own house. Build your own self. Build your own identity. To build your own heritage through evil games by coveting somebody else's ministry. There's ways about which we have relationship skills that we're able to go about talking to people who are in ministry, making suggestions and involving ourselves in the solution and not the problem. Somebody can come along and not that anybody's done this, don't get the idea that somebody's done this, but somebody can come along and say, well, you know, I'm just not real pleased with the way Rick's doing youth ministry. I really believe that if he would do X, Y, and Z, it would be a whole lot better. You know what? In my mind and in my heart, I honestly believe when somebody's doing that, they began coveting the ministry of somebody else. And they began to power play and to control in order to try to take that ministry away. If somebody honestly believes that the youth ministry needs to have X, Y, and Z, you know who they ought to get with to find out whether it needs to have X, Y, and Z? The person who's given responsibility and authority over it. 99% of the time when somebody comes along and begins to covet somebody else's ministry and tries to destroy it, they're not the ones that are involved in the ministry. They're the ones that are standing on the outside and saying what needs to happen on the inside. That's one way that we try to gain our security through power and through control. Another way is we're trying to gain God's approval through works. A lot of people in ministry start doing ministry not out of a pure heart of just serving God from what he's already done, but they're serving God in order to do something, in order to get something from God. They think, oh, if I'm involved, surely God's going to be more pleased with me if I do that. How many of you have ever done that? How many of you have ever made deals with God? When things are bad in life, the bottom falls out, hard times hit, you get caught in the midst of something you shouldn't be, all those kind of things, and you began to say to God, God, if you'll just get me out of this, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll serve you. I'll find a place. I'll find ministry. I'll do this. I'll do that. You think you're going to gain approval from God by doing those kind of things? No. You see, that's when you're trying to have control and have power over your life, trying to make yourself feel better. It's an evil game to build your house that way. It will end up being shameful. Another way is that you try to have power and control is to not make yourself accountable to anybody. To not make yourself accountable to anybody. And we do this in our lives all the time as believers, especially in America. We're autonomous people. I mean, we think we stand on our own and nobody else has any business looking at me and holding me accountable. In fact, I won't allow it if I won't join the church. I won't do this. I won't do that. I will not make that commitment that's going to make me accountable to anybody else. You see, that's us saying, I'm fortifying myself. This is my power. This is my control. I'm not going to let anybody else in here. I'm not going to make myself accountable in any way whatsoever to anybody. And if I have a ministry, it's my ministry. If I have authority over it, it's my authority. I do what I want to do all the time. That's it. I'm not going to be in obedience to anybody else. I am doing what I want to do, and don't you tell me how to do what I want to do. Oh, it's real easy to even be the pastor and become spiritually abusive that way. And it's real easy to become where you are, sitting there, and become spiritually abusive that way. In yourself, to just say, I am not going to make myself accountable to anybody. I am going to maintain the power and the control I have over my life. You see, that's when we commit spiritual suicide. We commit spiritual suicide when we begin to assume responsibility that's not ours, when we begin to assume authority that's not ours, and we begin to reject any kind of accountability in our life. You can count on it. Just like God told Habakkuk what would happen, the proud will fall, and Nebuchadnezzar fell. You can count on it. You and I both can count on it. If we get to the place where power and control are more important to our security than God Himself, we will fall. Another way that we try to hold on to security is through wealth. That is, placing our security in either gaining or accumulating wealth. How do we do that? There's a lot of different ways we do that as a believer. For instance, accumulating at the expense of giving. Accumulating wealth at the expense of giving. Thinking that wealth, money, and by the way, there's not many of us in this room, if any at all, that would not be considered somewhat wealthy in world standards. We all got plenty to eat. We've got plenty to live off of. We've got the things that we need, plus a lot more. But what about accumulating things for the purpose of getting our security from this at the expense of giving? You know, that's what happened in the Old Testament time. That's what was happening in Habakkuk's time, and that's what happened later on. And in Malachi, that's exactly what God said. You're robbing me because you're not doing what you're supposed to do with your money and your tithes and your offerings. You say, oh boy, there he goes. He's going to start talking about money. Got giving. No, it's not about giving. This is not about money. This is about security. And where do you get your security from? Do you get your security in what you've accumulated? You see, all Nebuchadnezzar was doing was trying to provide security for himself and for his family. Same as I do at my house. Same as you do at your house. Trying to provide some sense of security. And he was doing it with all this wealth. When's enough ever enough? When's the wall ever going to be thick enough? When's the palace ever going to be big enough? When's the garden ever going to be full enough? When's the checkbook ever going to have enough in it to really provide security? And it will never provide security. Because when you begin to place your security in your wealth, and you're accumulating wealth at the expense of giving, you're committing spiritual suicide. Not only in giving of tithes and offerings, whatever that is. So some people don't want to think. Some Christians don't want to pray and think and have God lead them through the ministry of the Holy Spirit in their life. They want some church, some preacher, some religious system to tell them how much to give. How much to give. You're supposed to give 10%. See, that way it's easy. I can just go home and figure up 10%. That's pretty easy. Well, a calculator. I figures it up really quick. And I know, and I can feel good about what I'm doing because somebody's told me that this is what you do in order to be right with God, and that's in my security. No, it's not. It's listening to the Holy Spirit's guidance in your life. And I would not dare to tell somebody how much they are to give. Because you see, it's not a matter of a simple percentage. Someone who makes $10,000 a year and has a family of five and gives $1,000 of that $10,000 to the Lord's work has given 10%. Somebody who makes $100,000 a year with a family of five and gives $10,000 that year to the Lord's work has given 10%. But I dare say one gave sacrificially and one didn't, because it's a whole lot harder to raise a family of five off of $9,000 than it is off of 90. You see, it's not a matter of simple percentage. It's a matter of heart. It's a matter of where the security of your life lies. 1 John tells us that if you see a brother in need and you're not willing to give to that brother in need, then how can the love of God live within us? What does our money tell us about us? What is our wealth? What about the accumulating of wealth at the expense of spiritual life? The rich young ruler came and said, "What must I do to have eternal life?" And you remember the story. Jesus said, Well, you got to follow the commandments. And he named all the commandments. He began to name the commandments. And the rich young ruler said, I've done all of those. And then Jesus said, okay, sell everything you have and follow me. And it says the rich young ruler went away sad. He went away sad because he told him something he couldn't do. Because his security was wrapped up in his wealth. How about the successful, rich, productive farmer who began to have his crops multiply and multiply so much so that his barns were not big enough to hold all of his grain. And so he said to himself, I will build bigger barns so that it can hold more grain. And I will have all that I need and that will give me security. And God said, no, it won't. Because before you get those barns built or after you get the barns built, your soul is dead. It doesn't matter. In the Old Testament, Haggai was a prophet after the return of Israel from the Babylonian captivity. And Haggai, in his prophecy, says that God was telling the children of Israel, you live in your nice paneled houses, but my house, the temple, has been destroyed, has been torn down, and you're not even concerned about building my place back up. And because of that, I've caused a drought to come upon your life and upon your land. And you've lost out of a lot of things. Now, get back where your security is supposed to be and go build my house. And you see, that's exactly what God says to us today. Our money tells a whole lot about us. It does. It tells a whole lot about us and all the things that we don't want to see. I mean, we can look in the mirror and see ourselves, but look into your checkbook and see yourself as well. That's a place we don't want to look at the reflection, because it tells a whole lot about where we place our security. And we may be doing it for pure motives a lot of times. We can say, well, I'm doing it so my family, I'm trying to provide a heritage, a legacy, I'm trying to provide for my family. Oh, yes, I understand. But how are you doing it? Nebuchadnezzar say the same thing. I'm trying to provide for my family. But how are you doing it? Oh, I don't think that you're probably robbing a bank to do it. I hope you're not, and pray that you're not embezzling money from your employer to do it. I hope that you're not swindling insurance companies in order to do it. But I think sometimes that we rob God to do it. And I think sometimes we rob from each other to do it. And sometimes I think we rob from the bride of Christ, the church, to do it. Because our security lies there. We think that wealth gives us some kind of idea of who we are. If I can only live in the other housing district, it'll make a bigger statement about me. Another way that we commit spiritual suicide is not only with power, control, or with wealth, but is with walls or fortified lives. Nebuchadnezzar built this huge wall. Can you imagine? 130-something feet thick. That's huge. I mean, that's thicker from the front of this building to the back of the building. It's thicker than this building. That's how thick this wall is, all the way around this palace. You know, you and I have got some thick walls that we secure ourselves behind as well. They may be walls of shame, that we feel shameful about things that we have no real need to feel shameful about. But our security is in this, behind this wall. I've done things in my past and I don't want anybody to ever know, because I'm ashamed of it. I'm shameful of this thing that's in my past that's holding me, and this wall is my protection. No. Maybe it's sin. Sometimes you and I live in sin and we don't want anybody to find out that sin in our life, and so we protect ourselves by building this wall around us, and we protect this sinfulness of ourselves. Sometimes it's because we've been hurt and our emotions have been rawed. They've been torn up, chewed up, spit out, regurgitated all over us, and it hurts bad. Sometimes one of the things we say is, I'll never let anybody get that close to me again. I'll never make myself vulnerable again. Sometimes it's at church where people stab us in the back while they're smiling to our face. And after that happens a time or two, we begin sometimes to build these walls around and say, I'll never make myself vulnerable again. I'll never get involved in ministry again. I'll never do any. I'll protect myself with the walls that I build. Anytime we try to find our security in life from our own power or our own control, or anytime we try to find our security in life from the wealth or the accumulation of things that we can gather around us, anytime we try to find our security in life through the walls that we can erect in our own life, anytime we try to find security in life in those things, we are sinning against ourselves. We are sinning against ourselves. We are committing spiritual suicide. For the only place that we can truly find security is in the heart of Habakkuk's prophecy. The righteous will live by his faith. The only place that we can find true security in life is through the imputed righteousness of Christ in our life. It's the only place that we can find it. Because through that imputed righteousness, through the faith that he gives us to live life to its fullest, we can let go. We don't have to have power and control. We can let go. We can assume responsibility. We can take the authority that's given to us, and we can be accountable to people. But we know that our security is in the righteousness of Christ. We can take our wealth and we can earn a living. And I believe that God gives us the blessing of living in a place where we can earn a living like this. He gives us the blessing of knowing something, of being able to make a good living in order to enjoy life. But we can do that without hoarding it all to ourselves, without accumulating everything to ourselves so that we can hold on to our security in this way. Oh, I think sometimes we rob God because we're saving up for a rainy day. Sometimes we rob God because we're a little afraid about what's going to happen next week. Sometimes we're not willing to really let go of those finances because that's where our security is. Instead of our security being in the righteousness of Christ, and if Christ tells us to let go, and that's what he tells us, let go, give. Sometimes God tells you, he gives you a figure financially to give, and you go, oh, man, Lord, decimal must be in the wrong place here. That's impossible. That's no way. I can't do that. It won't work out on the budget. And God says, let it go. Don't you remember the birds? Don't you remember the lilies of the field? Are you in control or am I? Are you getting your security from the righteousness of Christ being imputed in your life? And when God tells you to do something, you in faith step out and do it. Regardless of what your security means tells you, you look to him for security. Now the hard one. I believe it's the most hard. The most difficult thing we can do. When God tells us, tear down the walls. Tear down the walls. Get off of your arrogance. Tear down the walls. I know you've been hurt. Boy, I know you're wounded. And the church should never be someone who perpetrates more woundedness on anybody. But God tells us individually, tear down the walls.